conclusion is that we have made 85 leagues from our starting point. Then we are walking under the Atlantic now. Just so. And perhaps at this moment a tempest is raging above our heads, and ships are being wrecked amid the wild hurricanes. Likely enough. And whales are lashing the walls of our prison with their tails. Don't be frightened, Axel, they can't shake them. But to return to our calculations, we are in the southeast, 85 leagues from the base of Snæfell, and according to my preceding notes, I reckon we have reached a depth of 16 leagues. 16 leagues? I exclaimed. Undoubtedly. But that is the extreme limit of the Earth's crust, according to science. I don't say it is not. And if there is any law of increase in temperature, the heat here ought to be 1500 degrees. Ought to be, my boy. And all this granite would be in a state of fusion, as it could not possibly remain in a solid state. You see, however, that it is nothing of the sort, and that facts, as usual, give the lie to theories. I am obliged to own it, but still I'm very much astonished at it. How does the thermometer stand? 27 6/10. Then philosophers are out in their reckoning by 1,474 4/10. Then the proportional increase of temperature is a mistake, and Humphrey Davy was right, and so was I to listen to him. What do you say to it now? Nothing. I could have found plenty to say if I chose. I could not admit Humphrey Davy's theory in the least, and still believed in the central heat, though I did not feel the effect of it. I would really rather have admitted that this chimney of an extinct volcano, being covered with non-conducting lava, did not allow the heat to pass through it. But without stopping to seek for new arguments, I confine myself to the consideration of our actual situation. "Uncle," I said, "I have no doubt all your calculations are right, but they bring me to a rigorous conclusion."
"And what is it, my boy? Speak your mind."
"At the point where we are, under the latitude of Iceland, the radius of the Earth is scarcely 1,583 leagues.
It is 1,583 1/3.
Put down 1,600 leagues, in round figures. Out of a journey of 1,600 leagues, we have gone 12.
That's just it.
And at the cost of 85 degrees diagonally.
Perfectly so.
In about 20 days.
In 20 days.
Now, 16 leagues are 1/100th of the Earth's radius. If we go on at this rate, we should take 2,000 days, or nearly 5.5 years, to descend.
The professor made no reply.
Without reckoning that if a depth of 16 leagues is obtained by going 80 horizontally, that would make 8,000 leagues southeast, and it would be a long time before we reached the center, if we did not chance first to emerge at some point of the circumference.
"Hang your calculations," cried my uncle passionately, "and hang your hypothesis too. On what ground do they rest? Who told you, pray, that this passage did not lead direct to the center? Besides, I have a precedent. What I am doing, another has already done, and where he has succeeded, I can succeed too."
"I hope so, but at least I may be allowed
to hold your tongue, Axel, if you wish to argue in that senseless fashion."
I saw plainly the terrible professor was about to leap out of my uncle's skin, and I thought I had better be silent.
"Now," he said, "consult the manometer. What does it indicate?"
"Considerable pressure."
"Well then, you see, in descending gradually, we get accustomed to the density of the atmosphere, and we are not the least affected by it."
"Not in the least, except a little pain in the ears."
"Oh, that is nothing, and you can get rid of it at once by breathing very quickly for a minute."
"Quite so," said I, determined not to contradict him again. "There is a positive pleasure, even, in feeling oneself getting into a denser atmosphere,
Have you noticed the wonderful clearness of sound here?
Yes, indeed. A deaf man would soon get his hearing again.
But this density will, of course, increase.
Yes, according to a somewhat indefinite law. It is true that the intensity of the weight will diminish in proportion as we descend. You know that it is on the surface that its action is most felt, and at the center of the globe, objects have no longer any weight.
I know that, but tell me, in the end, will not the air acquire the density of water?
Undoubtedly, under the pressure of 710 atmospheres.
And lower still?
Lower still, of course. The density will increase still more.
How shall we descend, then?
Well, we must put stones in our pockets.
I declare, Uncle, you have an answer for everything. I did not dare to go any farther into the field of hypothesis, for I should have been sure to have stumbled against some impossibility which would have made the professor start out again. But it was quite evident that the air, under a pressure of possibly 1,000 atmospheres, would pass at last into a solid state, and in that case, even supposing that our bodies might have held out, we should be forced to stop, in spite of all the reasonings in the world. But it was no use advancing this argument. My uncle would have met me with that everlasting sucknusum, a precedent of not the slightest value, for even quoting the truth of the learned Icelander's narrative, this simple answer might be made to it. In the 16th century, neither barometers nor manometers were invented. Consequently, how could sucknusum know that he had reached the center of the earth? But I kept this objection to myself, and waited the course of events. The rest of the day passed in talking and making calculations. I always sided with Professor Liddenbrock, and envied the perfect indifference of Hans, who went blindly wherever destiny led him, without troubling himself about cause and effect.
Chapter 26. I must own that up till now things had not gone so very badly with us, and I should have been graceless to complain. If the average of difficulties did not increase, we must accomplish our purpose in the end, and what glory we should win. I began positively to reason like Liddenbrock himself. Seriously, I did. I wonder if it was owing to my strange surroundings at present. Maybe it was. For some days, we came to a succession of steep inclines, some of them almost frightfully perpendicular, which brought us a long way towards the interior. On some days we advanced a league and a half to 2 leagues, but these were perilous descents, in which we were greatly helped by the adroitness of Hans and his marvellous sang-froid. Thanks to him, we got over many a bad place that we could never have scrambled through by ourselves. His absolute silence, however, increased every day. I even think it grew upon us also. External objects have an actual influence on the brain. Anyone shut up within 4 walls loses the faculty at last of associating words and ideas. Look at prisoners in solitary cells. How they become imbeciles, if not insane, by the disuse of their thinking faculties. During the fortnight which followed our last conversation, nothing occurred worth mentioning. I can only recall to mind one event of any importance, and that I can never forget. I have reason to remember every particular of it, even the smallest detail. On the 7th of August, our successive descents had brought us to a depth of 30 leagues. That is to say, we had over our heads 30 leagues of rocks, ocean, continents, and cities. We must have been then 200 leagues from Iceland. That day the tunnel was but very slightly slanting. I was ahead of the others. My uncle was carrying one of Ruhmkorff's apparatus, and I had the other, examining the beds of granite. All at once, on turning round, I found myself alone. All right, I thought. I've been going too fast. Or Hans and Uncle may have stopped for a minute on the road. Come, I must get back to them. Fortunately, the path is not steep. I retraced my steps, and after walking for a quarter of an hour, looked round me. Nobody was in sight. I called out. No answer. My voice was drowned in the midst of the hollow echoes awakened by the sound. I began to be uneasy, and a shudder crept over me. "Be calm," I said to myself aloud. "I am sure of finding them again. There are not two roads. I was walking in front, so I must just keep going back." I went back for half an hour longer, and then I listened to hear if anyone called for me, for in so dense an atmosphere I should hear a long way off. There was not a sound. A strange silence reigned throughout the gallery. I stopped. I could not believe in my isolation. I had lost my way. I was not lost. I should get right again presently. "There is only the one passage," I kept saying to myself, "and as they are in it, I must come up to them soon. I have only to keep ascending. Unless not seeing me, and forgetting I was in front, they had gone back to look for me, but even then by hurrying I shall overtake them, that's evident." I repeated these last words like a man who is not very certain, and moreover it took me a long time to put my ideas together at all, in the shape of a conclusive argument, simple enough as they were. Then a doubt crossed my mind. Was I really ahead of my companions when I got parted from them? Certainly I was. Hans was following me, and my uncle came after him. He had even stopped for a minute to fasten his packages on his shoulder. I remembered this circumstance distinctly. It was at this very moment I must have gone on too far. "Besides," thought I, "it is impossible I could have gone far wrong, for I have a guide to lead me through this labyrinth, one that will never fail me, my faithful stream. I have only to follow it back, and I cannot help finding my companions." This conclusion reanimated me, and I resolved to set out immediately, without losing an instant. How I blessed the foresight of my uncle now, in not allowing the hunter to stop up the hole in the granite. This beneficent spring, after having refreshed us on the road, was now to be my guide through the winding mazes of the earth's crust. Before starting, I thought I should be the better of sundry ablutions. I dipped my face into the Hansbach. But judge of my stupefaction, I touched dry, rough granite. The stream no longer ran at my feet. Chapter 27. I cannot describe my despair. No human tongue could tell what I felt. I was buried alive, with the prospect before me of dying of cold and hunger. I passed my burning hands mechanically over the ground. How dry the rock seemed! But could I have forsaken the course of the stream? For here it certainly was not. Now I understood the cause of this strange silence, when I listened for the last time, expecting to hear a call from my companions. I had not, till this moment, noticed the absence of the stream. It is evident that just as I took the first wrong step, the gallery must have forked, and I had followed the new opening, while the Hansbach, obeying the caprice of another incline, had gone away with my companions towards unknown depths. How could I get back? There was not a track. My feet left no imprint on the granite. I racked my brain to discover the solution of this problem. One single word expressed all the misery of my situation. Lost. Yes. Lost at what seemed to me an immeasurable depth. These 30 leagues of the earth's crust were weighing down my shoulders terribly. I felt crushed. I tried to bring my thoughts back to the upper world, but I scarcely succeeded. Hamburg, the house in Königstrasse,
my poor Gräuben, all the living world beneath which I was lost, passed rapidly before my terrified memory. I saw, as if in some hallucination, all the incidents of the journey, the voyage, Iceland, Mr. Fridrikson, Snæfell. I said to myself that to have the faintest shadow of hope in my position would be madness, and that I had far better despair. What human power, indeed, could bring me back again to the surface of the globe, or tear down these enormous arches supporting each other above my head? Who could set me in the right track once more and take me to rejoin my companions? "Oh, uncle," I cried in accents of despair. This was the only word of reproach that came to my lips, for I knew how much the poor man would suffer while he was vainly searching for me. When I saw myself thus wholly cut off from human succour, incapable of attempting anything for my deliverance, I thought of heavenly succour. Memories of my childhood, of my mother, whom I had only known in the sweet days of my infancy, came back to me. I began to pray, little as I deserved that God should know me, when I had forgotten him so long, and I prayed fervently. This cry for help to heaven made me calm, and I was able to bring all my mind to the survey of my actual position. I had provisions enough for 3 days, and my gourd was full. However, I could not stay where I was any longer, but what course should I take? Should I ascend or descend? Ascend, evidently. Always keep ascending. I must then inevitably come to the part where the gallery had forked, and could I but regain the stream, I could at any rate get back to the crater of Snæfell. How hadn't I thought of this sooner? There was clearly some chance of deliverance here. My very first business was to find the Hansbach again. I rose up, and leaning on my iron-tipped staff, began to climb the gallery. The incline was pretty steep, but I walked on hopefully and unconcerned, like a man who has not the choice of roads before him. For half an hour I met with no obstacles. I tried to recognize the way by the form of the tunnel, and by the projections of certain rocks, and the disposition of the fractures, but no particular appearance recurred to me, and I soon saw that this gallery would not bring me to the point of demarcation. It was a blind alley. I struck against an impenetrable wall, and fell on the rock. What terror and despair took hold of me then, I have no power to depict. I was completely prostrated. My last hope was shattered against the granite wall. Lost in a labyrinth, amidst a perfect maze of windings, it was useless to attempt an impossible flight. The most terrible of all deaths stared me in the face. And strangely enough, the thought crossed me that if some day my fossilized body should see the light, what grave scientific questions would be raised by its discovery, 30 leagues below the earth's surface. I tried to speak aloud, but hoarse accents alone issued from my parched lips. I was gasping for breath. In the midst of my anguish, a new terror seized me. My lamp had gone wrong when I fell. I could not rectify it, and its light was paling, and would soon go out. I saw the luminous current always diminishing in the coil of the apparatus. A procession of moving shadows appeared on the gloomy walls. I did not dare to close my eyes, dreading to lose the least atom of this fainting light. Every instant, it threatened to go out and enwrap me in the blackness of night. At last, there was only a faint glimmer in the lamp. I watched it with trembling eagerness, concentrating all my gaze on it, as on the last ray of light that my eyes would ever see, before total darkness should fall on me. What a terrible cry escaped me! On the earth, even in the darkest night, the light never wholly abandons his rule. It is diffused and subtle, but little as may remain, The retina of the eye is sensible of it. Here, there was nothing. Absolute darkness made me blind in the literal acceptation of the word. Then I lost my senses. I got up with outspread arms, endeavoring to feel my way, but the attempt was most painful. I ran along wildly through inextricable labyrinths, always going down deeper into the heart of the earth, like a denizen of the subterranean regions, calling, shouting, howling, striking myself against projecting rocks, falling down and getting up again, feeling the blood trickling from me, and trying to drink it as it dropped from my face, and always expecting to come to some wall to dash my head against. Whither did the said course lead me? That I am ignorant of to this day. After several hours, no doubt, when all my powers were exhausted, I fell against the wall like a lifeless mass and lost all consciousness of existence. Chapter 28. When I revived, my face was wet, wet with tears. How long this state of insensibility had lasted, I cannot say. I had no longer any means of reckoning time. Never was solitude like mine. Never was abandonment so absolute. After my fall, I lost a quantity of blood. I felt myself deluged with it. Oh, how sorry I was that death had still to come, that it was not over already. I refused to think. I banished every suggestion, and overcome by grief, I rolled myself towards the opposite wall. I could feel myself ready to swoon again, and I thought with satisfaction that with it would come the final unconsciousness, when a violent noise struck my ear. It was like a long, rolling peal of thunder, and I heard the waves of sound lose themselves and die away in the distant depths of the abyss. Whence came the noise? Doubtless from some physical source, in the bosom of the terrestrial mass, the explosion of some gas, or the fall of some of the vast beds of the earth's crust. I listened again. I wanted to know if that noise would be repeated. A quarter of an hour passed. Silence reigned in the gallery. Nothing was audible but the beating of my heart. Suddenly my ear, which happened to touch the wall, was startled by a sound like distant, undistinguishable, inarticulate words. I trembled. Is it a hallucination? Thought I. But no. On listening more attentively, I could plainly hear a murmur of voices, but I was too weak to make out what was said, but that someone was speaking I was certain. I feared for a moment that it might be the sound of my own words brought back by an echo. Perhaps I might unconsciously have cried out. I closed my lips tightly and again applied my ear to the wall. Yes, yes, voices, undoubtedly. I dragged myself to some distance along the wall and then heard the sounds more distinctly. I could catch an indistinct murmur of distorted and unmeaning words. They sounded as if someone was humming them in a low voice. Once or twice I caught the word forlorad, repeated with an accent of sorrow. What did it mean? Who was speaking? Clearly either my uncle or Hans. But if I could hear them, surely they might hear me. Here! I called with all my strength. Here! I listened and watched in the darkness for an answer, a cry, a sigh, not a sound. A crowd of ideas ran through my brain. I fancied my enfeebled voice could not reach my companions, for it is certainly they, said I. What other mortals would there be here, 90 miles underground? I listened again. In trying backwards and forwards along the wall, I found a point where the voices appeared to attain their maximum of sound. The word forlorad again reached my ear, and the thunder sound, which had at first arrested my attention. No, I exclaimed. "It is not through this rock that I hear the voices. The wall is of granite, and the loudest sound would not penetrate it. The sound comes by way of the gallery itself. There must be a very peculiar acoustic effect." I listened once more. "Yes. This time I heard my own name distinctly echoed through the gloom. It was my uncle who uttered it. He was doubtless talking to the guide, and the word Forlorad was a Danish word. Then I understood it all. To make them hear me, all I had to do was speak with my mouth close to the wall, which would serve to conduct my voice, as the wire conducts the electric fluid. But I had no time to lose. If my companions happened to change their position, even by a few paces, the acoustic phenomenon would have been destroyed. I went close to the wall, and I said, slowly and distinctly, "Uncle Liddenbrock!" And I waited with painful anxiety. Sound does not travel quickly here. The density of the atmosphere increases its intensity, but not its velocity. A few seconds, which seemed ages, passed, and at last I heard these words,
"Axel! Axel! Is that you?"
"Yes, yes," I answered.
"My child, where are you?"
"Lost in the most intense darkness."
"Where is your lamp?"
"Out."
"And the brook?"
"Disappeared."
"Axel, my poor lad, take courage."
"Wait a little. I am exhausted. I have not got strength to answer, but talk to me."
"Have courage," said my uncle. "Don't try to speak. Just listen to me. We searched up and down the gallery looking for you. We failed to find you. I wept for you, my child. Then we came down again, firing as we came, always supposing you still on the channel of the Hansbach. Now that our voices meet, it is by a purely acoustic phenomenon, and we cannot touch hands, but do not despair, Axel. To hear one another is something."
During this time I had been thinking. A ray of hope, slight indeed, raised my spirits. First of all, it was necessary to know one thing. I put my lips to the wall and said, "Uncle?"
"My child,"
he replied after the lapse of several seconds. "We must first ascertain what distance separates us."
"Well, that is easy."
"You have your chronometer?"
"Yes."
"Well, take it. Call my name and note the exact moment. I will repeat it the instant I hear it, and you will again note the precise moment."
"Yes, and half the interval between the question and the answer will be the time required for my voice to reach you."
"Just so, Uncle."
"Are you ready?"
"Yes."
"Well, listen now. I'm going to call out your name."
I put my ear to the wall, and as soon as the word Axel reached me, I instantly answered, "Axel," and then waited.
40 seconds, said my uncle. "Therefore the sound took 20 seconds to ascend. Now, at the rate of 1,020 feet per second, that makes 20,400 feet, or nearly 4 miles.
"Nearly 4 miles," I murmured.
"Well, that is a practicable distance, Axel."
"But must I go up or down?"
"Down, and for this reason. We have come upon a vast hollow space into which several galleries open. The one you have got into must lead here, for I feel certain that all these earth fractures radiate from the immense cavern in which we stand. Rouse yourself and go on. Walk, crawl, slide down steep inclines if necessary, and you will find our strong arms waiting to support you at the end. Forward, my child, forward!"
These words filled me with new life.
"Goodbye, uncle," I cried. "I go. When I leave this spot, we can speak to each other no more, so adieu." "Till we meet again, Axel."
I heard nothing more. This singular colloquy, uttered in the bowels of the earth, exchanged at a distance of nearly 4 miles, ended with words of hope. I thanked God for having led me through the labyrinth of darkness to the only point at which the voices of my companions could reach me. This astonishing acoustic effect was easily accounted for by physical laws alone. It was produced by the form of the gallery and the conducting power of the rock. There are many instances of imperceptible sounds being conveyed to a distance. I've experienced the phenomenon myself more than once, among others in the gallery of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and notably in those curious caves in Sicily, and in the labyrinths near Syracuse, of which the most wonderful is known as Dionysius's Ear. These recollections occur to me, and it seemed obvious that, as my uncle's voice reached me, there could be no solid barrier between us. If I travelled the road by which the sound came, I'd need not despair to reach him unless my strength failed me. I rose. I dragged myself rather than walked. The slope was very great, and I let myself slide. After a little, the rapidity of my descent was alarmingly increased and threatened to turn into a falling motion. I had no strength to stop myself. Suddenly, my feet lost their hold. I felt myself rolling, and now and then striking the rough projections of what seemed to be a well, a sort of vertical gallery. My head struck a sharp point of rock, and I lost consciousness.
Chapter 29.
When I came to myself, I was in semi-darkness, lying on thick rugs. My uncle was watching me, hoping for a sign of life in my face. At my first sigh, he took my hand, and when I opened my eyes, he uttered a joyful cry.
"He lives! He lives!" he exclaimed.
"Yes,"
I answered with a feeble effort.
"My child," said my uncle, pressing me to his heart, "thank heaven you are saved."
I was deeply touched by the tone in which these words were spoken, and more deeply still by the attentions which accompanied them. But it required such dangers to excite the professor to such demonstrations. Then Hans arrived. He saw my hand in that of my uncle. I may say at least that his eyes expressed great satisfaction.
"Good dag," said he. "Good day, Hans," I whispered. "Good day. And now, uncle, tell me where we are."
"Tomorrow, Axel, tomorrow. Today you are too weak. I have bound up your head with bandages, which must not be disturbed. Therefore, try to sleep now, and tomorrow you shall hear all I have to tell."
"Well," said I, "at least tell me what hour, what day is it?"
11 o'clock in the evening, and today is Sunday, August the 9th. And I will answer no more questions till the 10th of this month."
I was really very weak, and my eyes closed involuntarily. I was in want of a night's rest, so I went to sleep, with the knowledge that I had been 4 long days in my state of isolation. Next day, when I awoke, I looked round me. My bed, composed of all the travelling rugs, was situated in a lovely grotto, adorned with magnificent stalactites, and the ground was covered with fine sand. Twilight reigned. No torch nor lamp was lighted, and yet gleams of light seemed to penetrate by a narrow opening in the grotto. I could hear, too, a gentle, undefined murmur, like the moan of the waves breaking on the sands, and now and again the whisper of a breeze. I wondered whether I was really awake, or if I was dreaming still, or if my brain, injured in my fall, was suggesting imaginary sounds. Still, neither my ears nor my eyes could be so far mistaken. It is really a gleam of daylight, thought I, that peeps in at that crevice in the rock, and I am sure that what I hear is the murmur of the waves. There is the whistling of the wind. Can I be deceived? Or are we once more on the surface of the earth? Has my uncle abandoned his expedition? Or has he brought it to a satisfactory close? I was asking myself these questions, to which I could find no answer, when my uncle came in. "Good morning, Axel," said he joyously. "I would wager a good deal that you are better." "Yes, indeed," said I, sitting up under my blankets. "That is right. You slept quietly. Hans and I sat beside you in turns, and we have seen you get better step by step. In fact, Uncle, I feel quite a man again, and you will say so when you see the breakfast I shall make if you give me the chance." "Certainly, my boy, you shall eat. The fever has left you. Hans has rubbed your wounds with some Icelandic nostrum, of which he knows the secret, and they have cicatrized with wonderful rapidity. Our hunter is very proud, I can tell you." As he spoke, my uncle prepared some nourishment, which I ate greedily, in spite of his advice, while at the same time I overwhelmed him with questions, which he did his best to answer. I then learnt that my providential fall had brought me to the end of an almost perpendicular gallery. As I arrived in the midst of an avalanche of stones, the smallest of which would have been sufficient to crush me, it was to be judged that part of the mass had fallen with me. This fearful mode of locomotion had landed me in the arms of my uncle, where I fell bleeding and inanimate. "I'm truly astonished," said he, "that you were not killed 1,000 times over, but, for God's sake, never let us part, for the chances are that we should never meet again." "Let us never part again? Then the voyage was not over?" I opened my eyes with astonishment, which provoked the question, "What ails you, Axel?" "A question that I want to ask. You say I am safe and sound?"
"Beyond a doubt."
"All my limbs uninjured?"
"Certainly."
"And my head?"
"With the exception of some contusions, your head is safe on your shoulders."
"Well, I am afraid my brain is affected."
"Your brain?"
"Yes. We are not on the surface of the earth again?"
"No, indeed."
"Well, then I am crazy, for I see the light of day, I hear the wind blowing, and the sea breaking."
"Oh, is that all?"
"Well, but explain to me."
"I will explain nothing, for it is inexplicable. But you will see for yourself, and you will understand that geological knowledge is far from final."
"Well, let us go out then," said I, rising suddenly.
"No, Axel, no. The open air might be injurious to you."
"The open air?"
"Yes. The wind is rather strong, and I forbid you to expose yourself."
"But I assure you I am perfectly well."
"A little patience, my boy. If you had a relapse, it would be a serious matter for us all, and we cannot afford to lose time, for it may be a long distance across."
"Across?"
"Yes. Take another day's rest, and we will embark tomorrow."
"Embark?"
The word made me jump. "What? Embark? Had we a river, a lake, a sea at our disposal? Was there a ship anchored in some subterranean port?"
My curiosity was strongly excited. My uncle tried in vain to quiet me, and when he at length saw that to deny me would do me more harm than to yield, he gave up the point. I dressed quickly, and as a precaution wrapped one of the rugs around me, and went out of the grotto.
Chapter 30. At first I could discern nothing.
My unaccustomed eyes closed against the light. When I was able to open them, I was stunned rather than astonished.
"The sea!" I exclaimed.
"Yes," said my uncle, "the Sea of Lidenbrock. And it pleases me to think that no navigator is likely to contest the honor of having discovered it, or deny my right to call it by my name."
A great sheet of water, the commencement of a lake or ocean, stretched farther than the eye could reach. The shore, sloping gradually, presented to the waves a beach of fine golden sand, strewn with the small shells in which the first created things had lived. The waves broke there with the echoing murmur peculiar to vast hollow spaces. A light spray was blown by the breeze, which sprinkled a few drops on my face. On this gently shelving shore, about 300 yards from the fringe of foam, curved gradually the last undulations of the steep of the rocky counterscarp, which rose with a widening sweep to an immeasurable height. Some of these had their edges torn into capes and promontories by the beating of the surf, and farther still, the eye could follow their outline sharply defined on the cloudy background of the horizon. It was a real ocean, with a varying contour of terrestrial shores, but lonely and fearfully wild in aspect. That I could see to a distance along this sea was owing to a special light, which irradiated the smallest details. It was not the light of the sun, with his glorious glittering darts, nor the pale, uncertain radiance of the star of night, which is only a cold reflection. No, the illuminating power of this light, its quivering diffusion, its clear, sharp whiteness, the low degree of its temperature, its more than moonlight brightness, all proclaimed its electric origin. It was like a continuous aurora borealis which filled this cavern, so vast in extent as to contain an ocean. The arch, or sky, suspended over my head, seemed composed of great clouds, moving bodies of vapor, which some day would certainly fall, by condensation, in torrents of rain. I should have thought that under such a heavy atmospheric pressure, water could not evaporate, and yet, from some physical reason which I was unacquainted with, large clouds were spread above us. But it was then fine weather. The electric masses produced a wonderful play of light on the very high clouds. Well-defined shadows were thrown on their lower folds, and often between two disjoined layers a gleam of singular brightness was thrown on us. In short, it was not the sun, for there was no heat. The effect was mournful, intensely melancholy. Instead of a sky, bright with stars, I felt that above these clouds was the granite vault, crushing me with its weight. And this space, immense though it was not large enough for the orbit of the humblest satellite. I then recalled the theory of an English captain who likened the earth to a vast hollow sphere, in whose interior air maintained its luminosity by reason of its compression. And the two stars, Pluto and Proserpine, described within this sphere their mysterious orbits. Perhaps he was right, after all. We were really imprisoned in a vast hollow, of whose breadth we could form no estimate, as the shore widened as far as we could see, nor of its length, as the eye was soon stopped by an irregular horizon line. Its height must be 8 or 9 miles. Where this vault meets the granite buttresses, the eye cannot decide, but a cloud was suspended in the air whose height must have been at least 2,000 fathoms, a greater height than is attained by terrestrial vapors, owing, no doubt, to the greater density of the air. The word cavern does not convey any impression of this vast space. But the language of human speech is inadequate to picture what may exist in the subterranean abysses. Nor could I conjecture what geological cause could have produced this great excavation. Could the cooling process have induced it? I knew from the narratives of travellers of the existence of celebrated caves, but none of them had such dimensions as this. If the Guacharo cave in Colombia, which von Humboldt visited, was not exactly ascertained to be 2,500 feet deep, it was measured with sufficient precision to warrant the assumption that it was not much beyond that depth. The immense Mammoth Cave in Kentucky boasts of giant proportions, for its arch rises 500 feet above an unfathomable lake, which has been followed for 30 miles without coming to the opposite shore. But what were these compared with the one I was contemplating, with its sky of clouds, its electric irradiation, and its vast ocean? I thought silently over all these wonders. I had no words to express my sensations. I felt as if I had been transported to a distant planet, Uranus or Saturn, and was gazing on phenomena of which my earth nature had no cognizance. To express such novel impressions, I wanted new words, and my imagination was unable to supply them. I looked, I thought, I wondered with amazement, not unmixed with fear. The unexpectedness of the spectacle had brought back the hue of health to my face. Astonishment was called to my aid and cured me by a new system of therapeutics. And in addition, the dense air was a source of invigoration by furnishing an abundant supply of oxygen to my lungs. It will be easy to understand that, after 47 days spent in a narrow gallery, there was infinite enjoyment in breathing this moist, salt-laden atmosphere. I had indeed no reason to regret having quitted my dark grotto. My uncle, already accustomed to these wonders, betrayed no surprise. "Are you able to take a little walk?" he asked. "Yes, certainly," said I, "and I should like nothing better. Well, take my arm, Axel, and let us follow the bend of the shore." I eagerly consented, and we began to coast along this new sea. On the left, the abrupt rocks, piled one on the other, formed a titanic group of imposing grandeur. Down the sides poured countless waterfalls, which flowed away in clear, gurgling streams. Light wreaths of vapour, curling here and there among the rocks, indicated the place of hot springs, and brooks ran down the declivities with a delicious murmur, and lost themselves in the common basin. Among these rivulets, I perceived our faithful travelling companion, the Hansbach, which here merged quietly into the sea, as if it had been doing nothing else since the world began. "We shall miss it now," said I with a sigh. "Ah," said the professor, "what matters whether we have that or another?" I thought him ungrateful. But at this moment my eye was attracted to an unexpected sight. 500 paces off, round a high promontory, rose a lofty forest, thick and close. It consisted of trees of medium height, shaped like parasols, with clear geometrical outlines. The wind did not seem to have clipped their leaves, and in the midst of gusts they remained motionless, like a forest of petrified cedars. I quickened my steps. I could find no name for these singular growths. Did they belong to any of our already known 200,000 species? And were they to have a special place in the flora of lacustrine vegetation? No. When we arrived under their shade, my surprise was not greater than my admiration. I found myself gazing on terrestrial products, cut on a gigantic pattern. My uncle named them instantly. "It is nothing but a forest of mushrooms," said he. He was right. Fancy the development of these cherished plants in a warm, damp atmosphere. I knew that the Lycoperdon giganteum attains, according to Bouillard, a circumference of 9 feet. But these were white mushrooms, 30 or 40 feet high, with a head in proportion. They were in millions. The light could not pierce their dense shades, and complete darkness reigned beneath these domes, which lay side by side like the domed roofs of an African city. But I was anxious to go farther in. A deathly chill was reflected from these fleshy arches. For half an hour we wandered among the dusky shades, and I felt it quite a relief when we regained the seashore. But the vegetation of this subterranean region did not stop at mushrooms. Farther on rose groups of other trees with discolored foliage. They were easy to recognize, the humble arbutus of the upper earth, but of gigantic proportions, lycopods, 100 feet high, monster sigillarias, tree ferns as tall as the northern pines, lepidodendrons with cylindrical forked stems, terminating in long leaves and bristling with rough hairs.
"Astounding! Magnificent! Splendid!" cried my uncle. "Here is the whole flora of the second epoch, the transition epoch, the humble plants of our gardens which grew as trees in the early ages of the world. Look, Axel, and admire. No botanist in the world ever was at such a show."
"You are right, uncle." Providence seems to have preserved in this great hothouse the antediluvian plants which scientific men have so successfully reconstructed."
"It is, as you express it, Axel, a vast hothouse. But you might with equal justice call it a menagerie."
"A menagerie?
Yes, indeed. Look at the dust beneath our feet, the bones scattered on the ground."
"Bones?" I exclaimed.
"Bones of the antediluvian animals?"
I eagerly examined this primeval dust, formed of an indestructible mineral, phosphate of lime, and had no hesitation in naming these immense bones, which only resembled dried-up tree trunks.
"There," said I, "is the lower jaw of the mastodon. Here, the molars of the dinotherium. There is a femur, which can only have belonged to a megatherium."
"Yes, truly, it is a menagerie, for the bones cannot have been brought here by a convulsion of nature. The animals to which they belonged must have lived on the shores of this subterranean sea, under the shade of arborescent plants. Look, there are even whole skeletons, and yet—"
"Yet what?" said my uncle.
"I cannot understand the existence of animals in this granite cavern."
"Why not?"
"Because there was no animal life on the earth, except during the secondary period, when the sedimentary formation was produced by the alluvial forces and replaced the igneous rocks of the primitive epoch."
"Well, Axel, there's a very simple answer to your objections, and that is that this is a sedimentary formation."
"What? At such a depth below the surface of the earth?"
"Beyond a doubt. And the fact can be geologically explained. At a certain period, the earth's crust was elastic, subject to alternate upward and downward movements, by reason of the law of attraction. It is probable that depressions were produced, and that portions of the sedimentary strata were engulfed in abysses opened suddenly."
"Well, that may be so, but if antediluvian animals have lived in these subterranean regions, who can say that some of these monsters are not still wandering in the midst of these gloomy forests, or behind these inaccessible rocks?" At the bare idea, I involuntarily scanned the various points of the horizon, but no living being appeared on the desert shores. I was a little tired. I went and sat down on the point of a promontory, at whose feet the waves dashed with a hoarse noise. Thence I could see the whole of the bay, formed by a bend in the coast. At the bottom, a little harbour nestled beneath the pyramidal rocks. Its calm waters were sheltered from the wind. A brig and 2 or 3 schooners could have lain at anchor easily. I almost expected to see some ship come out in full sail and put to sea before the southerly wind. But this illusion was soon dissipated. We were but too surely the only living creatures in this lower world. In a sudden hush of the wind, a stillness more intense than that of the desert fell upon these barren rocks and hung over the ocean. I tried to see through the distant mists, to pierce the curtain that veiled the mysterious horizon. What questions crowded to my lips? Where did the sea end? Whither did it lead? Should we ever behold the other shore? My uncle